Good evening and welcome. I'm Bob Baldu, the Executive Director of the Cornell in New York City program. And we're very excited to be able to host yet our sixth annual L. Michael Goldsmith Lecture Series. And we're very fortunate to have both a full house, and you can see we expected an even bigger crowd in our overflow area. And for those of you that thought we were going to seat you over there in the front, my apologies. We're still working on some of our signage. But it's an extraordinary opportunity for us to celebrate with some alumni. We have some very special guests this evening, and of course we're going to be talking about one of our favorite local projects here in New York City, and of course that's the Cornell Tech campus at Roosevelt Island. But let me speak a little bit about why we're also here, and certainly in Michael's honor, I want to acknowledge the Goldsmith family. Thank you for all coming out, and the friends of Michael, who also have been so supportive each of these years that we've been able to host this. So it's a great honor. And speaking about Michael and his legacy, besides being an exemplary husband, father, son, brother, and friend, Michael was a superb and dedicated architect who took his role very seriously when guiding and serving his clients. He always strove to ensure that those clients received the finest possible results in terms of aesthetics, practicality, and value. Interwoven with that commitment was his love for his profession, a love for his school, Cornell, and of course a love for his family. So we're also very fortunate that Michael also, of course, had an imprint here at 26 Broadway, the former Standard Oil Building. As you heard me talk a little bit last year, Michael designed and redid much of the lobby that we have downstairs, including the reception desk, and then also did the entire fit out of the 10th floor, which is one of the core facilities in this building. So Michael is definitely with us, and we continue to find surprises of linkages between this building and its legacy and Cornell and our alumni network. So we're also fortunate this evening that in his very, very busy schedule, we have Dean Kent Kleiman with us. Kent is incredibly busy these days, and we weren't sure he was going to be able to make it. We had a pretty challenging trip here today, juggling both commitments and possessions and a number of other things to make sure that we were here. It's amazing. He and I were just in China. We managed to cover, I think, about 16,000 miles, but we managed to have some pretty significant challenges today just over the past 220 miles. So we're very fortunate that Kent is here, dear friend, and of course, this facility would not be possible without his leadership, and I want to thank him personally because we've had a phenomenal partnership now for 5 years that I've been the director. And obviously the program has changed quite dramatically in the past 5 years, and we're looking forward to the next five and beyond. And I thank you all for being here this evening. And Kent, let me kick it over to you.
I'm one of the possessions that gave Bob such some headaches today. thank you all. It just feels so great to see this hall full of alums and friends of the college. A year ago and a month, I think, about 13 months ago, we were not here. This was just a dream, and to imagine that we're not only here and the students are here, but you're all able to fit in one room and you can hear us, we have microphones and projectors, and it's all working. It's fantastic. And let me say the obvious, so we would not be here, the microphones would not be working if it weren't for a most amazing executive director, Bob Baldu. So Bob, applause. Let me also recognize, I think, the first seven or eight rows, which is the extended Goldsmith family, or is it just... let me exaggerate. It's part of my job. Welcome to all of you. I know most of you, some of you, but I can't quite figure out who's married to whom. But it doesn't matter for tonight. It's just so fabulous to have you here. And let me also reiterate what Bob said. Thank you for your support for this lecture. It's the only endowed lecture that we do in New York. We're very proud to do it. And once again, it's going to be a spectacular evening. So thank you all for your support for that. So 2010, December of 2010, you all know that New York City under Mayor Michael Bloomberg launched a competition for a new applied science and engineering campus to be housed here in New York. 27 institutions were invited, global institutions. Some of them were not too bad. A year later, in December of 2011, four proposals were supported by the city, but one big prize, the first prize, if you will, went to the best of the institutions, went to Cornell in collaboration with the Technion. Nobody was more surprised, I dare say, than the administration at Cornell, including myself, but very, very happy. This is a huge, huge expansion and an important expansion for the university. 2 years later, exactly 2 years later, December 19 in 2013, President David Scorton signed a 99-year lease with the city for 12 acres on Roosevelt Island that is now for the rest of our natural life, part of Cornell University. 25-year-long project. The goal is to have 200 faculty and 2,500 students at the end of a three-phase build-out project. Speaking as a dean, that's four times as large as my college. We've been around for 148 years. Feels obscene to me, but you know. We currently have 160 students and 30 faculty, so we're well on the way for those milestones. But the most interesting part, surely, has got to be the academic mission. Very inventive, a kind of crucible of different way of thinking about graduate education. No departments, no deans. I think it's all going to be great. Instead, students and faculty working on projects that will have a great impact on society, using their knowledge and trying to transform it immediately into kind of socially relevant and economically relevant activity. So a very, very novel pedagogical experiment. And of course, the pedagogical experiment needs to have a very, very novel physical home. And so I think Cornell did a wonderful job of both framing up the ambitions of the physical plant and then finding architects who shared those ambitions to execute those things. With the FAB building, the first academic building in 2012, the value was generated, and I think it's a self-evident value this day and age, that the campus should, among other things, embody an attitude about climate change. This isn't the principal mission of the Cornell Tech campus, but it seems any responsible university building something of this size has to take on this question of how are we building for the future in a world in which climate change is probably a fact and not something to be stopped, but only to be mitigated. So we charged Tom Main, the architect of that building, to build as close to a net zero project as possible. Those of you who are in the field know that that's tough, if not to say almost impossible. But by the time we got to the third project that we were looking to find architects for, the housing, the dormitory and housing tower in 2012-13, we upped the ante. We figured if Tom Main can do net zero, surely we can find architects who can do even more than that. And more than that is, for those of you in the field, passive house. That is probably the toughest standard to try to achieve. It requires great innovation on the part of the architecture team, great collaboration with consultants, and a kind of chutzpah to think you can do it in a building that's going to be 20 plus stories, now 26 stories tall. There aren't many architects who are foolish enough to take on a project like that, especially with Cornell as one of the clients, but we found them. And it probably won't surprise you that both the founder of the firm that we found and one of the partners of the firm are Cornell graduates, Gary Handel and Blake Middleton. Gary Handel is the founding partner and managing principal of Handel Architects, started in 1994. Handel has grown to a firm of more than 150 architects, designers, and planners, and has offices in three cities, at least I'm aware of three, New York, San Francisco, and Hong Kong. His designs have been recognized by the American Institute of Architects, the Urban Land Institute, the Society of American Registered Architects, the Chicago Athenaeum, among many others. He received his Bachelor of Architecture degree from yours truly, Cornell University, and has lectured at numerous universities, and now we proudly can say Cornell as well. Gary, thank you very much for being with us tonight. I'm not done.
You're deep.
Believe it or not, Gary has a partner. Blake is a partner at Hendel Architects. Notable projects designed by Blake include the Ritz-Carlton in downtown Boston, two new academic and performance buildings for the Boston Conservatory, and the renovation of the historic Santa Barbara Bohr Amphitheater, which is an amazing project. Blake is a fellow of the American Academy of Rome. He holds both a bachelor and a master's degree from Cornell University, and he has taught studio for us, and he's a super teacher. So Blake, welcome as well. Thank you. The way the evening is going to unfold, Gary will speak. He's going to allow Blake to say a few words as well. And when they're finished, we have the honor of having Jennifer Klein with us. Jennifer Klein is the Assistant Director for Strategic and Capital Partnerships at Cornell Tech. Is that correct? Who oversees Cornell Tech's partnerships with third-party developers, including the key person, the key interlocutor for this project. She's going to join as a kind of respondent, and then the three of them will take a seat for Q&A that Bob will manage. And with that, let me turn it over to Gary. <Yeah. laughs>
Thank you, Bob and Kent, and a special thanks to the Goldsmith family for hosting this event. It's a special honor for us as Cornellians to be here. Blake, as you will find, is not a person of few words, but I've known Blake and we've known each other for more than 40 years, and we know each other from studio at Cornell. He's been a great friend to me, a colleague, a partner, and I'm privileged to have had him play such an important part in my life. This lecture has allowed us to reflect a bit on our education and its pedagogy, and how that's influenced our practice, and how it's affected the project that we're working on for Cornell. So perhaps the most important part of our education is not necessarily what we learned at school, but all of the unresolved questions that basically you can't stop thinking about after you leave. And so in studio, we learned that, you know, that architecture was part of the grand sweep of history and part of history. But how? What part? Was it merely a reflection of the forces that were in play at the time? Was it actually an actor, a participant, shaped by the participants who were involved in making it? And in a random class on Wittgenstein, a philosophy class, I learned that language itself was at the root of almost all philosophical dilemmas. So how to take this tool that we use to interpret the world and to communicate, and to, that is actually a mask that sometimes keeps us from seeing what's actually there, and how could we see more clearly? And so burdened and blessed with the benefits of that education and all of those nagging questions, we began to see the city as more than the sum of its constituent parts, as something that was actually shaped by the actions of its inhabitants, and seeing it not only as a mere palimpsest, you know, so that would reflect the traces of what had been gone behind, but almost as a living organism, that's something that was guided by those that were working within it. And so we began to see architecture itself as an act of urban design as almost a series of tactical interventions, almost like an infantry war to be fought block by block and building by building. And then we began to see our actions and our production as not only the making of the thing itself, but to imagine the creation of that thing as an action that had the possibility of being a catalyst for positive urban change. So we began to see our work, you know, architecture, not only as a noun, but as a verb. We decided to turn our attention to the buildings that are typically classified as fabric. The residential buildings, hotels, office building, and buildings and retail establishments that are seen as part of the texture of the city. And rather than the model of the Nolli plan, which basically makes the monuments, public spaces, streets and squares white, and basically sees that fabric as Black, we begin to see a much more nuanced composition, almost a symphony of grays with various degrees of publicity and privacy and access. And the first place that we got to test some of these ideas and to see if we could use architecture as a catalyst for positive urban change was in the Lincoln Square neighborhood in Manhattan. So this is an area bounded by Riverside South on the west, Central Park west on its eastern boundary, 72nd Street, and Hell's Kitchen on its south. And our site was bounded by Columbus Avenue, Amsterdam Avenue, 66th and 68th Street, and bisected by Broadway, where those red dots are, was a group of small commercial buildings, tenements, and taxpayers. The area was considered an inferior location for retail and residential uses than the areas surrounding it. And so this was largely due to the lingering consequences of an urban renewal plan from the 60s, which is similar to many of the places that we've been operating in. This the urban renewal plan demolished a predominantly African-American neighborhood known as San Juan Hill, which was the setting for the musical West Side Story. Eventually, it led to the creation of Lincoln Center and the Amsterdam Houses Housing Project, but it didn't do wonders for the retail on the street. So here you can see a blow-up of the site and what the four buildings that would eventually take place there. The complex itself was a four-building, 1.8 million square foot project designed to both attract retail tenants, residents, and other users. Ultimately, the project was composed of over 600 apartments, 200 hotel rooms, U.S. post office, 12 retail establishments, and what was at the time the largest sports club and movie theater complex in New York and probably the United States. We began to realize that in these complex mixed-use buildings, much like in the rainforest, there was actually a vertical ecology that actually could be put together that would take place. But it was actually a vertical economic ecology, and that certain things would thrive at different sectional elevations within the building. Retail needed to be close to the ground, needed direct access to the ground. Offices, hotels, the movie theater and sports club needed an access from the ground, but could actually live at mid-range. And for-sale residential would thrive if given access to height and views. And so here you can see the rough economic values that were established for the project in 1994. And then you can see approximately what they are today, which is actually a measure of success in the project. We also began to realize that by composing those different uses, by taking those different things, they would actually begin to act synergistically with each other. They would actually have an economic force multiplier, and that they would actually, each use would then reinforce each other use. And then we realized that those uses would basically activate streets and generate populations at different times of the day, a phenomenon that we call periodicity. And so that basically, that with these complicated mixed-use projects, it would actually put people on the street at different times, contributing to the life of the city. And these uses, also because of their various composition, would also bring diverse populations to the site. So it would be the opposite of a monoculture. So it really would begin to almost operate as an ecological organism. And so here you can see those initial four buildings, Lincoln Square on the upper right, Lincoln Triangle, the Phillips Club, and 1965 Broadway. And then here, the approximate number of people that actually traverse the site during the course of a year. And so you can see that the movie theater was the predominant, and these are old, and some of those numbers are higher and lower now, but the movie theater is a predominant driver, the sports club is a predominant driver, the various retail components, just driving traffic through the site. And you begin to realize the power of these programmatic elements. And so what had been once a dead zone as far as pedestrian traffic was concerned has now become a lively and vital part of the city And, you know, and actually, it's, you know, an Apple store located across the street, and they'll only go, you know, where tons of people already are. So basically, by that measure, it's a success. And then, it's hard to ascribe causality, you know, exactly to these things. But the economic success of this project gave other developers, residents, retailers, and users the courage to come to this neighborhood. We ourselves have done three additional projects in that neighborhood since that those buildings were initially completed, and we've been surrounded by the work of others. And so now Lincoln Square is increasingly a very desirable place to live.
We should take credit for all that. I wish we had taken a percentage. I'm gonna just jump on top of the groundwork Gary laid and try to move through this quickly because you're all anxious to see what's going on with the Passive House project. And so all of this is really about just setting a table a little bit about the idea of buildings of a certain magnitude and shape and their impact on the urban environment. And that is really part of the groundwork of what we do in our practice. In Boston, the same model started getting applied in a number of different cities, and we were privileged to be able to be involved with a client that was really interested in investing in these downtown areas and historic city centers, Boston and San Francisco in particular. And in Boston had the same sort of litany of ills that sort of fell into sort of midtown and downtown centers. The old theater district devolved into the combat zone. Was not a place to wander around if you were trying to stay alive, and yet with all that sort of suburban flight that had occurred during the post-war era, there were over and over again various cities would look for models to try and revitalize downtown urban centers, and the typical model ended up oftentimes being another kind of monoculture, except on steroids: more office, more hotel, maybe more retail. Boston and San Francisco both had the same kind of situation. And what's interesting, and these projects would sort of get off the ground, start moving, demolition would occur, and then a recession would hit and the whole thing would collapse. And a lot of that has to do with the scale of the project. Our client saw in this area here, and I don't, does this? Yes, right there. So you see these empty lots here? Well, that was all created when this was being planned, and they wanted to tear all this stuff down. They tore it down. Then it didn't go forward. Our client saw a diamond in the rough, however. Despite the sort of lingering effects of the combat zone in Boston, there was this idea of taking the same model that Gary was just describing in New York, spread out in multiple buildings, concentrated in this case in Boston in two buildings. And you can see the program here, a very intense mix of program. And the big paradigm change in this, of course, is the quantity of residential, which was much different than what was going on in all these prior projects for the previous 15 years. So you're going to see that theme play itself over and over again. We call these like it's an urban megavitamin. The residential component in particular kind of juices the whole activity around the building and creating that periodicity of people coming and going to the neighborhood wherever these projects are built. This is the equivalent of what is inside these two buildings in Boston. And of course now, 15 years later, this was finished in 2001, the two buildings that you see over on the far side, on the far side there. And since then, you know, there's been restoration of the streets and another building there. And it has had a dramatic effect on the downtown area of Boston, which was not a place that was considered an appropriate location for, you know, middle or even high income housing. And this has dramatically changed the landscape in a positive way. It's a much different sort of environment now in that area. These were the first two buildings. Since then, we did that building. Then we've got this guy under construction. It's the renovation of the Filene's building by Daniel Burnham. And I'll come back to Burnham in a minute. 1912, when this was the last project he did before he died. And it's been an astonishing set of the level of investment and development that's occurred since the initial projects were announced has been quite something. The same scenario at the same time in a similar size area in downtown San Francisco also occurred, starting in 94, 95, one of our first projects there. the same problem of what was, you know, sort of fantastic, you know, but vital residential neighborhoods in this area, and moving over towards the waterfront of San Francisco was essentially, you know, longshoremen housing and other blue-collar housing that had devolved in its kind of quality, and the city fathers felt like it was important to come up with a new idea. And so between the sort of degradation of the commercial district on Upper Market Street and the sort of, decline that was going on in this neighborhood, this area right here, which is what we're talking about, which is called Yerba Buena Gardens now, Yerba Buena Center originally, was demolished. It had the same problem of red light districts and Skid Row sort of, you know, building around it. This ended up being the result of the urban renewal, but then things stalled because once again there were all these plans for these big mega projects starting and stopping. The Moscone Center, the convention center, finally sort of began to anchor part of the redevelopment there. And when we arrived on the scene, the Arts Center had since then been built on part of it. I'm not showing the buildings, but the location, a fantastic theater by Jim Polshek and Todd Schliemann. And Fumihiko Maki did the Visual Arts Center next door. So those buildings were sitting on top of the convention center, but the rest of the site was left open. And this became the first building, the Metreon, which was a huge retail and theater building, and then subsequently the residential tower for the Four Seasons, and then an accretion of a series of other projects that we've been doing for the last 18 years now, including this open space here. So it hasn't been just buildings as a series of set pieces, but it has been an accretion of these investments and changes. A new open space here, Jesse Street Plaza, and then this Willis Polk building facade that was preserved behind the Dan Liebskind Jewish Museum, built in here. This is from 1908. The Aronson building here from 1903, one of the few buildings that survived the 1906 earthquake, and we're now doing a new tower project and the Mexican Museum right here, renovating all this and building another tower here. So all of this stuff is accreting over time around that site. And once again, you know, this possible causality of these kind of smaller scale interventions. These aren't mega projects. These are more discrete series of projects. And again, the measure of success is there, seen in the huge amount of investment and building that's been going on up and down now Mission Street and on part of the Market Street corridor.
I wanted to stay up.
Yeah.
So this approach towards architecture and urban design has led us to work in cities around the world and to be part of the global conversation about how those cities are changing to meet the evolving needs of their society, and also how architects can be part of that conversation. That conversation is in full swing at Roosevelt Island, and Kent went through some of the timing of this, you know, basically the announcement. But one of the things I think is amazing about Roosevelt Island is the vision that's behind it, which is really to combine the innovation potential of Silicon Valley with the financial power of Wall Street to create an economic engine to power New York City for the next century. That is a transformative concept, you know, and basically you couldn't actually put forward a better mission statement. I love the little statement on the bottom, which basically says that if companies founded by graduates of MIT were an independent nation, it would have the 17th largest economy in the world. So that was part of the RFP. So that really gives you the scope and scale of the ambition for this project. And basically, as Kent mentioned, with the gift of basically a very generous alum, Cornell was actually allowed to win over rivals who were thought to have an edge, notably Stanford.
I love beating those guys. That was really, really, really great. let's see, how do we, here we go. So, and as Kent had mentioned, you know, there was a very quickly out of the box, and even in the part of the original response for the RFP to the city, were some very interesting concepts for the master plan of the campus. And I'm not going to go into all the details of all of that, but it was very interesting because the sustainable design goals were I think, dramatic. There was the intent to make sure that this was an innovative campus in all ways, not just in its mission, but also in terms of the architecture and the planning. One thing to point out about this, just for those that may not know, is that you'll notice very intense PV panels all over the place in the, on these various buildings. But the master plan really was looking at an idea about opening up the grain of Roosevelt Island on diagonals, and to use the north-south ordinance, the actual compass ordinance overlaid on the island, as opposed to, let's say, mimicking the Manhattan grid, which, as everyone knows that lives here, is rotated about 23 degrees, right? Something like that?
29.
All right. And that led to some interesting, sort of design issues. There are four major buildings in this first phase, as Kent was alluding to. Both what was the FAB is now called the Bloomberg Center. The bridge, which is a co-location building that Weissman Frady is designing. And then the Verizon Executive Education Project. Is it public yet?
Yes.
Yes, that Sonoeta is doing in the sort of fourth building. What was really interesting to us, and it was an incredible thing when the RFP was out for the residential building, we were like incredibly excited, and then we got, yes, and every Cornell architecture alum is going after this thing also. So how are we going to nail this one, you know? And I think, you know, for just briefly, a couple of things. One is that we already had prior experience on Roosevelt Island, so we kind of knew the lay of the land pretty well. We also, I think, understood, as we were trying to show in some of this earlier work that we've been involved with, the power of how buildings like this really can change an environment. And also, we have incredibly deep knowledge in terms of how residential buildings of this size and magnitude work. And that, coupled with our aspiration for meeting the sustainable design goals that Cornell was putting out there, seems like it played out, and they ended up selecting us for this thing. What is interesting is that there was a interesting kind of tug of war that started going on with the master plan, with the different architects, and at the same time still trying to preserve the character of these diagonal passageways through the site. A master plan had been developed and then had gone through a whole city approval process for the rezoning of the island. And that's kind of important because it also established the framework for where these building footprints had to go. So go back one there, and you can sort of see the current basic shape and configuration. The interesting thing to us was that what might have been the most prosaic project, a residential tower, you know, on a campus with a high-tech classroom environment, a co-location building that would bring lots of businesses and vendors together with students and faculty, was actually turning out, it evolved into something that we think is going to have a tremendous impact on the world of building, which Gary will talk about in a minute. So we came to this with a, you know, specific location. It was the tallest building on the campus. By the zoning that was approved. And there was a master plan that, I'll jump ahead here, but that the other issue that was interesting for us is that we were the third, or really the fourth architect, going through the city approval process, both with Cornell, Hudson Companies, our developer client, along with Related, and as a partnership. It was interesting to think about the design approach and proposal, knowing that there were already two other buildings designed. So the context went from being a kind of a tabula rasa into something where there was architecture, there was an approach to what those designs would be all about that we had to respond to in our design approach. The mission of what the residential building was all about, I'm not going to go through all of this, but it really, you know, I think there were sort of four major goals that capsulized what both the mission of the university and how the building itself would, who would be using it. And then down here was basically 270,000 square feet, 26 floors, about 500 beds were required, thinking about the future in terms of the future build out of the campus. And most importantly, is who was living in there. And it was a very unusual potential residence in this: graduate students, postdoctoral students, faculty, and PhD candidates. That was the main charge that we were told these are the folks that are going to be living there. And that was really interesting to us because, like, okay, how do all these brainiacs, you know, when they get together in these apartments, what's that going to be all about? That led us into a kind of an intensive period with Cornell and Hudson related in terms of programming the building. And there were some really interesting ideas and that we messed around with and looked at and had a lot of dialogue with the client on that. We had to think about, as we do in many of our residential projects, what's the kind of character and lifestyle going to be in these buildings? These are habited spaces. They take on a life. They impact people that live in them day in and day out. What was that going to all feel like? What could it be all about? And so these are just some ideas about the different kinds of spaces that could be part of the programming of the building. And these themes here, you see sort of body-mind and career-enhancing and downtime became part of the sort of underlying themes of the interior design and layout of the apartments. I mentioned the idea of the master plan and the city's requirements for each building, when we came to the Public Design Commission, had to meet these sort of basic criteria. And so each design team that came forward had to show how they were accommodating some of these primary principles dealing with the river-to-river experience. Roosevelt Island, if you haven't been out there already, is like being out on a big ship. There's water very close to you on both sides. It's constantly moving. It's a very dynamic environment. And the light plays a very particular role, I think, in terms of bouncing off the water. Indoor-outdoor relationships, optimizing the performance of this building, and how would users actually engage in the systems of the environment of their buildings, open spaces, the north-south spine, there's a strong ridge that runs down through the center of the island. All of these things were components that had to be part of the design. Now, of course, we can't get rid of our own DNA at Cornell, and that ended up playing a role in terms of our perception of what this was all about. Recognizing that we had an opportunity here because of it being the tallest building, it was also going to be a significant marker for the campus on an urban scale. And if you now drive around on the FDR Drive or go across the bridges on the East River, you'll see what I'm talking about. You can see the frame of the building now, and it does stand out. The way we put it all together basically ultimately ended up being somewhat conventional in terms of the organization. There's no basements in these buildings because of the floodplain situation on the island. So we have mechanical spaces on the first several floors, actually, because there's some very intense equipment required to operate a residential high-rise building. So amenity spaces would be located on the ground level, along with the lobby here, seeing and then the second floor also, and then basically looking at the rooftop as another incredible opportunity to locate social space for the students and families that will be living in this building. And the mix of apartment types that we're looking at, micro apartments all the way up to three bedrooms, very tight, relatively modest in their scale. It's a rent-driven project, so these aren't big, grand spaces, but they're going to be very comfortable in more ways than one, which Gary will talk about when we get into some environmental considerations for Passive House. How do you break up the block? So we were handed a site that was essentially a big, long rectangle, and it had to be extruded 26, 27 stories. And because of the elbow room required and the efficiencies that we had to create in the plan, the first order of business was figuring out a way to shape the building that would begin to break down that slab-like character that was sort of baked into the zoning of the site. And so these are just a series of kind of formal operative diagrams. But the big idea was creating this thermal wrap. When we started, there was a strong desire to look at Passive House as a possible means to achieve this very high performance design criteria. But there was, this was new to everybody. It was a huge challenge. And so we knew that we were going to make a very kind of intensive high performance facade. We just didn't know whether we were going to be able to meet the Passive House requirements. So it still remained a sort of fundamental part of the design expression. So it was like a big thermal wrap. We sometimes call it the overcoat for the building. And what do you do with that once you have this sort of 16-inch thick wall that you can begin to shape? And that led to some ideas about kind of splitting the building open at a particular spot where some overlooks could occur to the campus. It could begin to mark the entrance, if I can get that right down here. Then shearing the top at that point to really create a distinctive profile of sky as part of the urban marker for the island. And then you could even fold the big wrap up, and almost like a, you know, folding up a hem on a skirt, and reveal the lobby beneath, and setting up the view from the lobby back out over the porch, as we call it, looking out over towards the river. So quickly, here's some plan organizations of the building, the ground plan. You can see the main entrance right there. This whole space really seen as an indoor-outdoor space. We call it the porch lounge. It's a multi-purpose space there. And then all that support space in the back of the mechanical equipment and other support space for the residential building. We've got 300 bikes or something that we're storing in this building. So we're very bike-friendly on Roosevelt Island. And then upstairs in that main space is also a fitness room that overlooks the two-story lobby and also looks out over the river. The apartment arrangement is relatively conventional. You'll notice that this is a concrete frame building put together with simple sheer walls. These are the micro apartments in here. They're code compliant, unlike many proposals that have come out on in the press over the last 4 or 5 years about micro apartments, and they're pretty cool in terms of the way they're arranged. And then you can see some twos and threes. And then there are fewer apartments on the upper two floors. Those are for faculty who may have families also, so they tend to be a little larger. And then when you get to the top, there's two types of amenity spaces. One's what we call the river room, which looks back out over, that's right here, looks back out to the the west towards Manhattan. And to the south over the campus, and then also this more informal space here, looking out over these terraces. This has a green roof, and there's a lot of indoor-outdoor connection up there, and it's going to be heavily populated during the spring, summer, and early fall. I can guarantee you that. What is also interesting is thinking about this thick wall and knowing that we've got all those apartments, all those relatively small rooms, a lot of windows required. How do you organize and place those in such a way that you begin to make some sense out of it? We ended up looking at this concept where by putting them together in a series of bands and kind of pressing it in tight into the surface, creating this sort of deep recesses around it to accentuate the thickness of the wall, that became the sort of organizing principle to deal with some erratic locations on the facade. So that was kind of an organizing principle there. Another cool thing is we're using this phase-shifting paint. I have to credit Morphosis with sort of bringing this idea to the surface to our attention. I'm not sure if they're still using it on their project. Jennifer's saying yes, so they are. They were looking at a kind of a green and copper, metallic tone. We were very interested in the idea of something much lighter in a kind of a warm silver, almost champagne color. And this paint is really cool because depending on the angle of incidence in which the light hits and which way you're looking at it, it will literally change color because of how that works. So this is a little picture here that actually shows, that same metal looked at in three different times of the day in different kinds of weather conditions. So that was another device besides the fracturing of the facade surface to kind of break up the massing of the tower and make it optically a more interesting experience. This is a view. You saw some pictures outside of the porch, looking back out over the kind of rear yard of the bridge building, which is right here, but we co-opted that and made that our front yard. That was the whole sort of concept there. So none of these triangular spaces that open out over the river are going to waste. They're all going to be fantastic outdoor rooms. Here's an inside view during the daytime. It's a little hard to see, but the presence of the 59th Street Bridge as it runs back out over to the Queens there is a very powerful presence visually, and it's going to be something that really plays a big part in, I think, in everybody's experience in the building. So this is where we are, and this is all, that's what's in it. So then the question is, how does it work? What does this passive house mean, and how do we get there?
And as Dean Kleinman mentioned, this will be the largest and tallest passive house project in the world, and not by a little, by a lot. And we actually thought that that was important given the mission of Cornell and the siting of this as an applied sciences campus. Why is that important, aside for bragging rights. The world's population currently stands at around 7.3 billion people, all of whom want a better life for themselves and their families. And those legitimate desires are putting incredible stress on our planet and its resources. That population is expected to grow to over 9 billion people by the year 2042. Why is 2042 important? In 2042, basically, if we follow current trends, atmospheric carbon levels will reach 450 parts per million, and scientists consider that the point of no return, the point where climate change is irreversible. And if you look at the bottom line of the graph, that's the developed world. And if you look at that sort of brown line, that's the developing world. So 90% of the growth in carbon output between now and 2042 is projected to be in the developing world based on the legitimate desire for them to improve their economies. So if we're going to prevent this from happening, we need to do a couple of things. We basically need to stop our reliance on fossil fuels. The developing world, the developed world, needs to make a little bit of room for the developing world, and we need to find ways to do radically more with radically less. Cities are a good way to start. You know, basically, as density increases, in general, carbon consumption and energy consumption go radically down. An exurban, a household in an exurban setting, basically uses 6.5 times the carbon of a household in a carless urban area. We can establish that cities are inherently more efficient than other areas, and density is a good thing. But basically cities that are dense, like New York, are. And New York is actually the most energy efficient city in the country, but it's about half as efficient as Hong Kong is, you know, for example. And in New York, energy use in buildings basically contributes to 83% of the total source energy and 71% of greenhouse gases. And this is in the most energy efficient place in the country. Can that be dramatically reduced, and can technology play a role? Recent advances in technology and these are things that we take for granted, would seem to say yes. So basically, an LED light is a 750% improvement over the 60-watt incandescent lamp that we grew up with. A Tesla is 750% more efficient than the 1950s fleet average. Water utilization is falling dramatically with advances in technology. And with Passive House, we have the ability, and so this is a 370% improvement, if possible, which is basically a 70-cent reduction in energy use tracked against buildings of similar size in New York City, which is the most energy efficient market in the world. So that basically, these things are within our reach, and these are the kinds of things that we're going to need to grasp if we want to avoid the tipping point. What is Passive House? Passive House is the most rigorous energy efficiency standard in the world. It's not a checklist, it's not a formula. It's based on absolute energy use. It basically has an emphasis on the enclosure, on ducted fresh air, and a super efficient HVAC system. It relies on achieving a few very simple, devilishly rigorous criteria. And there's no room to hide. So basically, you need to use no more than 38 kilobtu per square foot per year. And so that's what gives you the 77% energy savings. And you need to have an envelope which is 10 times tighter than a standard building, which basically doesn't let that energy leak out. So that basically that you have, you're only allowed 0.6 air changes for hour, per hour under 50 pascals, which is under pressure. So basically it almost has to be a totally sealed environment. And in order to support that, you need to have ducted fresh air and a heat recovery system. So those are the basic components. So it's very simple on its face and really hard to achieve. So it starts with proper solar orientation, which we were given by the master plan, which is actually fortunate. So that basically with the broad sides of the building facing north and south, and the short sides facing east and west. And so that's on true north based on that 29 degree kick to the New York City grid. And then this reduces solar heat gain in the summer. We then have that thermal wrap that Blake talked about. So this is essentially an R32 wall wrapping around the building that ties together at the mechanical porch, which is where you see that the two seams of the building coming together. And at that seam is where the mechanical system of the building goes. And so this is a very simple variable refrigerant flow system that basically supplies tiny bursts of heating and cooling to terminal units that are located within each of the rooms. The building is so efficient that the smallest available terminal unit is 4 times larger than what we need. So we're working with manufacturers to try to actually have them make a new terminal unit that will be basically more suitable for passive house. We could actually achieve better energy savings if this unit was available. And then because the building is sealed so tight, all of the exhaust air in the building is collected and brought up to the roof, where basically it is mixed, and it's not mixed. So basically ducted fresh air is brought into the building, and it's basically the exhaust air is fed through what's called the heat enthalpy wheel, which allows us to recover more than 77% of the latent heating and cooling energy that would have been lost in that exhaust and mixed with that, you know, that basically that heat is recovered into that ducted fresh air. All of that fresh air is run through a series of HEPA filters. So basically the quality of the air that you get coming out of the duct is substantially better than the quality of air you'll get if you open up those windows. In order to achieve the tightness required, we're using a prefabricated panel system to do the cladding for the job. So you can see those panels, each of which will be about story height and 36 wide. And basically by relying on prefabricated panels, we get a very high degree of quality control and get to minimize the work in the field where most errors are likely to occur. So the panels come completely glazed with their windows, with all of the insulation in place, all of the sheathing, all of the cladding, so they can be erected, and a vapor impermeable barrier on the back, so they can be erected and taped up. As Blake mentioned, that wrap is about 14 to 16 inches thick with an R32R value. And we've worked incredibly hard to make sure that the air and water seals and vapor barriers are basically continuous through every aspect of the facade. So basically you can see the green line is the continuous vapor retarding barrier. The blue line is the water barrier. The cladding sits outside of that. And those little clips are a special thermal break that basically isolates the cladding from the structure of the panel. The windows are Schüco AWS 75 triple glazed window with warm edge spacers, a fully thermally broken frame, and all of the major cavity voids stuffed with insulation. So that sounds pretty cool, but basically the net result of that is it's a window that's 2.64 times better than a standard high performance window. So that block is set into the frame with insulation, taped and sealed in order to maintain the continuity of the air and water barrier. The panels then come to the site, and that the gap between the panels need to be sealed to the level equal to that of the construction of the panel itself. So the gap is filled with the same mineral wool that we're using on the panels themselves, a double Cox seal on the outside, and more vapor impermeable tape is used to seal those panels to basically to make the panel join. The entire job is really reliant on the integrity of these seals. So this is Alex Yelizarov, who's our construction manager, just groaning about the amount of work that we needed to do in order to get this done. Basically saying we need to seal the shit out of this thing, and that's exactly right. That's the only way that this thing will work. We'll be using over 7 miles of that vapor impermeable tape in order to button up this building, in order to keep it, so that, as tight as it needs to be. So here you can see the exterior panel in our mock-up test. The red dashed line are the panel joints. And you can see the panels basically being fabricated in the factory here, and basically with some of the preliminary air and water seals going in. So basically, at the end of the day, the entire building will be pressure tested, so that there'll be a blower test that basically pressurizes the building, and if you don't pass, you're not passive house. So basically, there's no place to hide. You either pass or you don't. Basically, it's not about getting 52 points in your lead checklist and collecting gold. It's really a rigorous performance standard. So along the way, this is a pressure test of the mock-up to basically see if the theoretical assembly will pass. We'll be doing field testing in local spots and basically spot checks along the way. But at the end of the day, the entire building has to pass. In order to meet the the 38 kilobtus per square foot, we basically need to avoid thermal bridging. So basically, at every point in the project, we've basically looked to see where heat might leak out. Where those mechanical units are actually set outside the thermal envelope of the building on a little mechanical porch. And that porch is isolated from the rest of the structure with this really cool Shock Isocorb SM20 thermal isolator that basically prevents the heat transmission from going from that slab to inside the slab. And at the fold that Blake mentioned at the porch, a similar device is used, which is a steel-to-steel isolator, which is a Shock Isocorb S22 that basically prevents the steel-to-steel thermal bridging when we actually take that wrap and turn it down to basically prevent the transmission of heat from that heat and cold from that canopy into the building. And then this is maybe my favorite. Basically, at the door to that mechanical unit, we're using an off-the-shelf walk-in cooler door that you might find in a restaurant to actually get out, into that to service that mechanical unit, and it has an R32 value, which is the same as that wall. So what's the net? So that basically, if all buildings were built to passive house standards in New York City, we basically would be able to reduce energy use by about 60% and basically greenhouse gas emissions by about 52%. And if this standard was applied in other places which are less energy efficient, those effects would be multiplied. Bill Gates, when he was at the climate seminar, basically at summit in Paris, when they basically signed the climate deal, talked about the role that technology has to play in combating climate change. And so projects like this are demonstrations. And I disagree a little bit with Kent about the mission of the university. I think there can be no higher mission than to basically show what's possible that can be done with actually not extravagant resources to basically face the challenges that are facing us. And I'm proud of Cornell for basically undertaking this, and we're really pleased with our role on the project. Blake?
So we're not done, almost. See if we can get in here without breaking anything. So just briefly, it's rising. These are some construction photos of the building as it stands now. I talked about that presence of the bridge, which is incredibly palpable on the campus out there, and it's going to be quite something. And as we've been talking about, this is also off-the-shelf technology being put together in a particular way, which is requires an incredible amount of coordination and intense focus. There's a picture of one of the panels going up in place that you can see there. So it's conventional building systems, but put together in an unconventional way. And you can see the three major buildings under construction from that aerial shot there also. It's a huge team effort. None of this can be done just by architects or builders alone. The engineers, are particularly the mechanical engineers, Julie Janiski and her team from Bureau Happold, Lois Arena from Stephen Winters Associates, who's been our passive house guru on the project, and certainly Cornell related, Hudson, and then in particular, the whole team from Monadnock Construction has been an amazing group of people. It doesn't stop. You can't just sort of walk away from the project and sort of, sign off on various forms, this, that, and the other. Everybody's out there every week, if not every day, watching carefully as all these parts and pieces go together. As Gary said, failure is not an option in this endeavor, and it requires a lot of focus and attention and perseverance over a long period of close to 2 years for construction. So, save the date. There's going to be quite an opening on the campus, and we expect to see everyone there at the top of the building. I have to say, I'm still trying to figure out how to put the chimes from the Eurus Bell Tower up in the top corner of this building so that everybody will know what time it is instead of just looking at their iPhones when they're wandering around on the campus. Thank you very much for having us. So Jennifer Klein is going to join us because she has been a stalwart in this whole process from architect selection into implementation right now. And I think we're going to open this up for questions and any discussion that folks would like to have.
First, before we jump into the Q&A, I wanted to make sure that we gave Jennifer a chance, since she has come out to see us tonight. We'd love to share some of your thoughts from, say, the Cornell perspective. We're certainly given the importance of all those fine young minds and some of the elderly minds in that space. We'd love to get your sense of kind of the expectations and some of the maybe the programmer elements that you think are really critical to this project.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always very impressed, and I feel like I learn more every time I hear these guys talk about the design and the true impact that this building will have, not only on the campus, but really on the change that we'll see in New York City and the change more broadly, and kind of what you were reminding me of, Gary, when you were talking about if every building is developed to passive house, what the changes will be. And I think what's really unique about this building and what we're able to do in terms of change is think about and act as an example in New York City, in development, as an institution. What's so difficult is not just the design, while the design is incredibly difficult, but what's difficult is getting people to invest in passive house in a different way of thinking. It's difficult because of the codes that we have in New York City in building and some of the mechanical systems that are required. You have to get a lot of variances to do this type of construction and design. It's difficult because people want to imagine very tall buildings with amazing views, all glass. And it's hard to get people to kind of see beyond that and clad the building in both metal and glass, and while also framing views. And so what I think is really exciting about this building is how it will shine as an example for future development. And in a way, acts very much in the same role that Cornell Tech wants to act in the larger economy in New York City, but in the development of New York City and more broadly in other urban areas. Mm-hmm. So we're just really proud of that.
Great. I just wanted to throw out a couple of questions just to get us going. Because one of the things that I think is so challenging, one of the things that we share with our students, is to understand that the role of the architect
also includes the ability to bring that team together, especially given the sophistication that's required to do this, and given that it's at a scale that's unprecedented, as well as the complexity of what Jennifer was just outlining in terms of whether it's code, cost, or even just issues of being able to get people to believe in it. I was just curious how you assembled your team and how you've been able to really communicate and keep everyone together to be able to reach this goal.
Honestly, like it's pretty much an axiom that, you know, great buildings require great clients, and Cornell's been amazing, as has Related and Hudson. David Kramer, particularly at Hudson, didn't take very much convincing. And so basically he said, "Can you do it?" And we didn't know that we could, but we said yes.
That's the chutzpah part?
We believed that we could figure it out. And then, as Blake mentioned, at Related, there's a gentleman by the name of Luke Falk who is there. Sustainability guru, and so basically he was just waiting for us to come around, you know, with something this juicy that he could push through, so that we had great support. The interesting thing was really, it took us about 6 months to get the contractors on board, because just basically, but when they finally realized that this was going to happen and that it was totally reliant on their craftsmanship to do, they stepped up, and so basically, and that was an amazing day, because we had been just saying, you have to do this, we have to know that it's done, so we actually want you to do checklists, and we actually want you to walk around and make sure that it's done properly, and it was no. And then we just go, look, we're not going to make it if you don't do this. We will fail, right? And there's nothing that we can do, and it's on you to bring this home. And so there was just an acceptance of that responsibility one day. And basically Alex, who you saw there, basically I think that was his moment of realization, that basically that holy shit, I'm gonna have to seal the fuck out of this shit. So that I think was the, I think that, the team was on board. They were up for the challenge. Getting the contractors on board was a little bit of a challenge. But Monadnock Construction is actually owned by Nick Lembo, who is a Cornell alum, architecture school, basically gone rogue into the dark side. So I think he might have had a little bit to do with the cooperation of his team. Is that an answer?
No doubt, that's great. Just one more before we open it up. And Max, will you give me a hand? I'm going to let you run the mic for me while I stay up with you guys up here. And let's hope the battery works, if not, poke somewhere around. The other thing that really strikes me, and this goes back to Ken's point about the integrity of the academics and the innovations associated with Cornell Tech, given that it has a different model of integration, no departments, no deans, or at least some figure as a dean. But I was just curious, when you look at the kind of stacking of the residential units, and if you look at some of the historical models, you think about the University of Virginia, and certainly Cornell for a long time had this exploration of faculty living directly with their students. And I was just curious, it seems like it's for stacking and needs. I was just curious, I saw the program, but how does that really, is there an understanding of the pedagogical components of how those two really work together?
Funny you should mention Jefferson, because that was exactly the analog that we presented, I think, to Cornell, which was really conceiving this as like the University of Virginia, an academical village, but turned vertically instead of horizontally, right? And so that idea of mixing, how that mix was going to occur with faculty living in their, little apartments, whether they're pavilions on the UVA campus or they become apartments within a stack of 26 floors. That was part of the exploration early on. There were big questions. Should they be in the middle? Should they be spread out through all the different floors? We started getting interesting feedback from some of the other housing advisors from Cornell and other places, and the faculty said, "Nah, I don't think so. I think we want to be in our own perch, wherever that might be," which is ultimately why we ended up with them, near the top of the building. That's not necessarily a hierarchical thing. It really had a lot more to do with where sort of creating an internal environment where some of these different groups, they're all going to meet and constantly cross paths in the lobby and in these various social spaces. But they also want to go to their own kind of zones, if you will, sort of their neighborhoods in a way. And so that was revelatory, I think, during the design process as we were programming the spaces. There were some, you know, some very interesting ideas about how to mix it all up. Right. But in the end, it seemed like it was a better thing to kind of let it be semi-segregated. You know?
Yeah, the real trick was trying to figure out how to get them to live there at all. So we were actually shocked to learn that faculty don't really want to live with their students. And so we thought if we gave them great apartments with great views and really cheap rents, we could probably make it work. It was really the economic motivator, getting to look back, at the skyline views of Manhattan with fantastic apartments with a significantly below market rent could probably be the enticement to create this 24/7 learning environment that we were hoping to create within the building.
Mm-hmm. One last one before we jump out. One of the things that we found out through some of our conversations with some of the operational engineers is that you start off with a great building design and then you build it. But then there's this transition where the operational engineers actually need to be educated to be able to actually make sure the building functions as you designed it. And I was just curious if anyone's been able to kind of think about the operational life of this, because we've certainly talked with Burrell Happel and Arup and found that these super high performance buildings sometimes are undermined in that transition to the operational engineers that don't quite get it. And I was just curious if there's any thoughts on that.
Certainly we think that there's going to be a big learning curve and a period of education for our operator, who is related management. So they're already playing a big role in the development. So they're one of the development partners. I don't remember if it was Gary or Blake mentioned, they have an individual who's incredibly educated and forward thinking in sustainability. And so that's a real core part of their principles. Mm-hmm. But there is certainly going to be an education process with the actual people who are going to be managing these systems. What's interesting about, I think, Passive House, from Cornell's perspective, we kept asking these questions like, is the air going to feel really stale? What about us opening the windows? We're going to have 500 people living in here that want to open their windows. Is going to offset the entire climate? And so the design needs to take into account all of that kind of user interface and actually is designed to allow for a lot of that. And so there isn't going to be a lot of user education other than maybe the education of the type of building that they're living in. But certainly from the management perspective and the systems, there's definitely going to be an education process.
Right. Max, does it work?
No, not working yet.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to raise our voices up, and I'm going to start with you.
This maybe sounds like a hardball question, but it's really going to turn into a softball question. What's the delta between what the cost of this Passive House construction is versus normal development, just bringing in under, whatever. And when you build a building, it's not just the construction cost, but it's the operational cost, which are usually something like 20 times what the construction cost is. So I'm assuming that the operational costs are going to offset whatever difference in construction costs to get to that.
Yeah, so this is not a radically expensive project. Basically we're estimating the hard cost here at about 5 to 7% more than standard construction. And basically, given the energy savings, we think it actually is economically rational in terms of its payback, which is why I think Jen said it actually can be used as a model for future development beyond, academic settings where there is, a mandate to do this. We actually feel comfortable enough now with what we've learned here to take this out to a standard developer and say, you should think about this, that we know how to do this within a rational cost frame, and that basically that if you look at your return, we think it's not that bad of an investment, even in terms of economic terms, forgetting about the benefits to your own, the world and your reputation.
My question has to do with the future of this building. There are multiple phases here, and from what I understand, there'll be additional residential buildings, and eventually, instead of being mixed with faculty and dormitory, it would become all dormitory. So I wonder, in your planning of the building, whether you took into account that one day it will become dormitory, and therefore it'll be maybe the smaller units as opposed to three-bedroom, two-bedroom.
It's not designed to start, you know, reconfiguring all these apartments. I mean, these are essentially conventional apartment layouts and super efficient in terms of the way they're set up. My understanding is it's going to remain student and faculty housing for the foreseeable future. Remember, this is a 20-25 year build out going on, and the campus is going to continue to slowly get, you know, more populated with students and faculty. There will be one or two other residential buildings at some point in the future. But I don't think dormitory, that was a word that was excised out of our conversation practically from day one. This was not a dormitory. This is a residential hall. And the mindset is a lot different. Dormitory means you're sharing all sorts of, you know, common things like bathrooms and showers and all sorts of, you know, stuff. And that's not what this is. These are apartments. Everybody's got their own private sort of enclave, a small kitchen, one to two bathrooms in each apartment. It's a really great setup. There is one central laundry on that second floor, so with really high efficient, you know, laundry machines. Again, the outside air, all that air control had to play into the design even of the laundry facilities.
Go ahead, Joe, you take it first.
One of the reasons that, well, I'm so glad that you covered so many aspects, took so many things into consideration, but I thought of another one. One of the reasons that waterfront property is so valuable and that people love to be near the water is that you have negative ions coming from rivers, from oceans, bays. And in the sealed building, was that taken into consideration? Can the negative ions still penetrate into the spaces? And if the better than natural air system were to fail, is there a backup system so that people could breathe still?
There are operable windows in the, you know, in the building, you know, basically, and then the HEPA filters take contaminants out, not ions. So basically, the air is fresh, you know, that's coming into the apartments. We're really just taking out contaminants and actually extracting the heat and cooling energy from the exhaust that we're taking up to not lose the potential of that energy.
First of all, thank you. This was wonderful. And second of all, a simple question. I know, I remember, Blake, in the beginning, you mentioned about that because of the floodplain, I think there's no basement. But you come from Maryland, Chesapeake Bay. What about the rising sea issue?
Yeah, so what's our ground floor elevation?
17, I think?
18,
somewhere
up there.
Yeah.
So, the
19.
FEMA, you know, so the FEMA flood elevation for New York for this area is approximately elevation 11. In order to get flood insurance, you need to be at approximately elevation 12. We're at elevation 17. So we're good for a while. We really hope we start to bend the line on that curve so that we're not faced with the armoring of all of, you know, of New York City to basically deal with the consequences of, you know, catastrophic climate change. You know, that's really, you know, that's one of the reasons why we're excited about this project. But again, no city, no country, no project is, you know, invulnerable to, you know, what's facing us.
Thank you.
What design elements were considered, suggested, actualized to encourage the cross-fertilization of academic ideas in the classroom building? I know you discussed what might have been in the passive housing. And number two, what impact or consultation, if any, has begun with Technion?
So the first, just to recap, the first question is what were the considerations in the Bloomberg Center in the academic building to achieve
cross-fertilization ideas?
The idea of open spaces within I think actually all of the buildings on the campus is a pretty common theme. We have a major area that we call the Galleria, which is both visually open, so you're engaging with people and you can see people, and there's a lot of areas where you can have open collaboration. There's the idea in the Bloomberg Center is that there are no walls, there are no offices, that people interact with one another, students engage with faculty, and the architecture all embraces that idea and actually forces that interaction on many, many levels. You actually see that in the Bridge building, which is designed by the Weissman Freddy team, and Cornell is taking up about a third of that building as well. So there's a lot of similarities in terms of the open engagement that facilitates that interaction. And the second question was?
Technion's role?
Technion's role. So Technion is a partner in Cornell Tech, and we work closely with them, particularly on certain institutes from academic programs and some degree granting programs, particularly the 2-year master's programs. And there's a lot of faculty that comes and visits the campus, and they'll have a major role, but they are focused on the institute itself and not Cornell Tech. So Cornell Tech has a lot of Cornell University professors. You're welcome.
That was fascinating, but the question is, we live in a 35-year-old building and so much of Manhattan are older buildings. Can any of this be applied to making these buildings much more energy efficient and get closer to the negative rate that we're now exposing ourselves to?
Absolutely. Yeah. So basically, Passive House is regulated by a group called Passive House Institute, and they're actually working on a set of standards for existing buildings. And so the same basic principles apply in terms of tightening up the envelope, which can be done adding additional insulation at the perimeter. Basically, windows in general in New York City buildings are being replaced every 25 years if you're living in through one of those window replacements. And basically, when that's done, it's a great opportunity to basically do more.
So is that a law, not every 25 years?
No, but it just basically, most of the windows are really not that great, they don't last that long. So basically, most buildings come up for a cycle of renewal every 25 years. Most buildings are working to put in, and basically this is, an eventual mandate, much more high efficiency boilers in their buildings to basically stop burning, crappy number 5 oil. And basically most of them are switching to natural gas, which is a bridge solution to an all electric, solution. We've done a couple of renovations of buildings from 1925 to 1935. Where we basically have introduced variable refrigerant flow systems into those buildings to basically go to an all-electric high-efficiency system with high-performance windows and additional insulation. So it's totally possible. It's not as easy as it would be if you were building a building from new, but a renovation is never as easy as an alteration or a substantial renovation.
We have time for a couple more questions.
Two questions. First of all, congratulations. You pulled a hell of a lot of rabbits out of the hat in the time. You actually are an example for the rest of us on how to do things and how a snake can swallow an elephant or whatever you did in the process of doing this. It's really amazing. But two questions. One is your fees. Today, so we talked about the hard costs going up. Did the soft costs go up? Good question. And then with that, however, and it gets into a bigger question, how do we, in a time when fees, after yet another recession, have gotten yet tighter, how do we swallow elephants if we're snakes? Or how can we rise to these kinds of challenges, which are the ultimate challenges? And yet, you've done it. How does one do that? Yeah, wonderful. Fine. All that. Okay, fine. But, you know, what do you do internally in your office, in your procedures, in your everything? How do you do that? What do you do? What is the magic in that?
Duty above and beyond the call. It's very simple. And yeah, I feel like Gary and I have made a significant long-term donation to Cornell University through our fee structure. So Kent is going to leave us alone for a little while. but you know, actually, the last part of your question. You know, so fees. Look, it's there's some intense coordination work, but this was also a beta test project at this scale. And that the next time we undertake something like this, we know what to expect. We know how to anticipate that. I don't think it's going to have a dramatic effect on our fees because it's detailing the same way you detail any other decent building that you would be putting together. And the mechanical system coordination is the same act of effort that goes on between the engineers and the architects and eventually the contractors. That scale of effort doesn't change. It's just because a lot of this was uncharted territory. And we're talking live. This is going on as we speak. You know, these field meetings that go on every several days out at the construction site. So I don't see a huge impact, you know, one way or another. From the construction side, perhaps a little more intensive supervision of the various trades for all the reasons that Gary was talking about. So that may be where the uptick is. I'm not sure there's a significant uptick one way or another for a design team. If we do this again, I don't anticipate that. I should say that I'm not going to say where or for whom. We're already looking at doing what I think will be the next world's largest passive house in a city not to be disclosed. And it's for a development team who is seriously committed to the ideas and the impacts of what buildings of huge scale can have in terms of energy consumption, and they're willing to look at this path very seriously. And it takes advocacy on the part of designers for this. And I think as Gary mentioned, you know, every client that comes to us now, we talk about this in some early conversations, or maybe third or fourth conversations, so they don't scare them and they run out the door and not come back. And it's really interesting in the development world, too. There are a number of very well-known legacy families that have been here for a number of generations building for the long term, for their children and grandchildren, and they've been doing it already for three or four generations, and they're going to continue doing it for the next generations. That message resonates with development teams that are in it for the long haul and not building for the short term. And the idea that a building can achieve these kinds of energy savings for them also has great value and is something that a protocol that a number of them are really seriously starting to look at. And we hope when this project's done and when we push the blower door test button and everything comes out, you know, just the way it's supposed to with no negative pressure problems, that's going to be a big moment because people are going to look over there at Roosevelt Island and say, okay, they could do it, and there's no reason why we can't do it either. Again, it's all off-the-shelf technology. There's nothing exotic about this.
Although you did get the panel manufacturer to do something that they, several years before, would never thought they would want to, could do materially.
Yes. You know, so basically, you know, sometimes you just have to step up and you ask other people to step up. And, you know, this is an issue that's on everybody's mind. And there's nobody that we've talked to who doesn't want to do the right thing. So, you know, so sometimes you just have to just go, I'm in, you know, I'm going to lead, you know, like, and so basically everyone who's involved in this project will achieve success at some point. They will basically be able to bask in the reflected glory of having done this. And basically, you know, nobody may make the amount of money on this project that they might have on a typical project. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It's really not important. It's not why anybody who's involved in the project is doing it.
Last question, and Max up. You have a question yourself?
I do have a question.
There you go.
My question was the nature of the site itself being on an island, given the innovative delivery system for the agreement that was made with the Roosevelt Island community to barge materials in. Did that factor into the actual materials you were bringing to the site, what you were thinking about when you took to the building?
Yeah, I think there was a natural dovetailing of the, in particular the facade system, with the delivery, the required delivery system, a significant amount of construction material for all the projects, right, are being barged over from Brooklyn and other locations. And so the fact that these could be prefabricated, trucked to the Brooklyn site and then offloaded, put on the barge, just brought up the river and then offloaded again and then just taken right onto the crane and popped right on there, because the site is like right next to the dock, right? And so it's a fantastically efficient way to kind of shortcut, you know, the inherent problem of vehicles crossing over to Roosevelt Island from Queens and trying to mitigate a not insignificant impact on the local community for that traffic. So that was not the reason why we picked the panelized system. It really had a lot more to do with cost efficiency and thermal efficiency, frankly, because the fewer number of those joints, you know, imagine if it had been, you know, a third of the size panels, it would be 21 miles of tape instead of 7 or something like that, right? So there were other reasons that we were looking at the panelized system besides the, you know, the shipping and implementation, but it dovetailed nicely with what the construction plan that Cornell had agreed to proceed with the local community.
Okay, well, let's put a hold on that, and then we can move in to the gallery so we can continue and celebrate a little bit and continue the conversation.
Thank you.